Coming up, as anti-Muslim speech continues, Kim Lawton talks with Christians working to overcome it. Also, as scientists search for intelligent life in the universe, Lucky Severson asks, how would finding it impact religion? And a Holocaust survivor tells her story to teenagers.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. The tentative ceasefire in Syria has all but fallen apart. Weeks of increasing violence culminated with airstrikes and the destruction of a hospital in Aleppo, affiliated with the medical charity Doctors Without Borders, killing dozens of people. Among the dead were three children and six staff members, including the area's last remaining pediatrician. Meanwhile, Doctors Without Borders has relaunched rescue operations in the Mediterranean Sea after it accused Europe of failing to save migrants who are in danger. The Vatican hosted its third conference on stem cell research this week. The Catholic Church objects to the use of embryos for stem cell research, but supports the use of adult stem cells. Vice President Joe Biden was among the political leaders on hand. Both he and Pope Francis pushed for international cooperation in the fight against cancer. Pope Francis has given 16 teenagers the unexpected opportunity to confess their sins. Youths ranging in age from 13 to 16 sat face to face with the pontiff in St. Peter's Square. The Pope spent more than an hour with them. The Pope also told the young people that happiness can't be downloaded like a cell phone app, and that being out of touch with God is like being somewhere there's no cell phone reception. The teenagers were visiting the Vatican as part of a special three-day event related to Francis's Jubilee Year of Mercy. Governor Bill Haslam of Tennessee has signed a bill that allows mental health counselors in private practice to turn away gay patients. Under the new law, therapists are allowed to justify their refusal to treat patients by citing their religious beliefs. The legislation shields the therapists from lawsuits and from being prosecuted or punished by a licensing authority. There was more religion-related controversy on the campaign trail this week. Interfaith and Muslim groups are criticizing Republican frontrunner Donald Trump for remarks in his foreign policy speech about immigrants and refugees.
We must stop importing extremism through senseless immigration policies. We have no idea where these people are coming from.
In response, the Interfaith Alliance issued a statement asserting, quote, "We must remain vigilant in our message that no faith is our enemy and our nation is open to all." There's been a lot of negative campaign language about Islam this election season. Calls for banning Muslims from entering the U.S. and for patrolling Muslim neighborhoods. But there are also serious attempts to oppose anti-Muslim rhetoric. In Nashville, Tennessee, Kim Lawton found efforts to counter the hateful speech by building personal relationships between Christians and Muslims. One of the leaders of that movement is Reverend Josh Graves, the pastor of an evangelical church.
In a wealthy suburb of Nashville, this small group is gathered to meet some new people and make some new friends. But this is far from a typical social mixer. Half of the people here are Christians and half are Muslims. They've come specifically to bridge interfaith divides. Helping to break the ice is a local evangelical pastor, Josh Graves. He says in a climate often marked by fear and bigotry, Christians have a spiritual duty to get to know their Muslim neighbors.
The stereotypes lose their power because they're replaced by true, authentic relationships. It's very hard for people to care about people they don't know. That's just true of humans, wherever you are on planet Earth.
This election season, interfaith groups have been condemning anti-Muslim rhetoric by candidates and political campaigns across the country. Several groups have launched national initiatives in response, with anti-Muslim legislation and rallies moving forward in many communities. Interfaith leaders are also calling for more local efforts. Nashville is sometimes nicknamed the buckle of the American Bible Belt, but its Muslim population has been growing rapidly. The city now has the largest Kurdish population in the U.S., leading some to jokingly refer to it as Little Kurdistan. Muslims here say they have felt the sting of anti-Muslim rhetoric.
Every single week, there's radio hosts who bring on people whose sole purpose is to badmouth the religion of Islam or to talk bad about the Muslim community. And I'm talking about very popular, so-called conservative radio hosts. And the practical effect of that is there's a real hatred that's constantly being whipped.
It's often discounted as rhetoric. In fact, what happens is the candidate is speaking directly to me, speaking to my wife, to my child. And it is not easy to discount such rhetoric when it's about you.
I think the most impact of this fear of what's going to happen is on our kids. They are most worried about it, especially my daughter, who's a 12-year-old. She's worried that, you know, we may have to move from here.
Josh Graves is lead minister at Otter Creek Church of Christ, a megachurch in the Nashville suburb of Brentwood.
It's almost impossible as a white, educated, affluent Protestant male to understand what it's like for my Muslim neighbors to hear the rhetoric. What I do know is that I have a responsibility because of my sacred texts, because of the example of Jesus, because I have children. I have a responsibility to speak out.
What is your response when you see this rhetoric seeming to resonate with some evangelicals?
It grieves me because it betrays the fact that people don't always know what's actually in the Bible. Love of God, love of neighbor. Here's the whole essence, Jesus says, of everything that I stand for.
Graves is author of the controversially titled book, How Not to Kill a Muslim, a manifesto of hope for Christianity and Islam in North America. Although many evangelicals have not been active in interfaith efforts, Graves urges his fellow Christians to counter hate by building meaningful relationships with Muslims. He raises those themes as an adjunct Bible professor at Lipscomb University, a local Christian university. Otter Creek Church has sponsored several events bringing in Muslim speakers to explain who they are and what they believe.
You have to look beyond the tag, beyond her scarf, beyond my name, beyond my skin color. You have to see more.
In addition, Graves and some of his church members have joined forces with a local interfaith group, the Faith and Culture Center, for the A Seat at the Table initiative, where Christians and Muslims share a meal together.
From what I've read in the Quran, in the New Testament, and in the Jewish scriptures, hospitality is a central discipline of life. You can't get around it. Like, what you do with your pots and your pans is what you really think about your religion.
In our culture, it is very important what we say, that unless someone breaks bread with you on the table, he's not a friend. So this is very important. That builds a relationship, friendship, and we need to foster that.
This meal took place at the home of Otter Creek Church members Jerry and Sandra Collins.
I've become convinced that the kingdom of God is not in the hereafter, it's right here and now, and we can be a part of that. And I want, in some small measure, despite my sins and shortcomings, to be a part of the kingdom of God.
We have friends we know who are exclusive, who would not appreciate this. And I was thinking, when I learned that you're going to put this on television, that I may have family members, I may have friends in other states who'll be so shocked. I hope not. I hope they'll say, hooray, I'm glad they did it.
We're speaking of people.
Organizers say the most important part of the meal is the conversation that takes place.
Nobody's asking for approval, people just wanting to know that they're safe in our presence.
Here you meet people to people, and the people to people contact certainly allays all kind of fear and suspicion.
Amir Arain is a neurologist at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. He and Graves have become good friends. Often when evangelicals reach out to people of other faiths, the only goal is to convert them to Christianity. Graves says that's not the case for him.
Ultimately, I think Jesus is the most compelling thing that's ever happened in human history. I hope Amir becomes a disciple of Jesus in the same way he hopes I become a disciple of the Quran. So we've gotten that out of the way, and then we live our lives. The end game is working together for the flourishing of the city you live in.
Graves says he has wide support for his interfaith work within his congregation, but he acknowledges some parts of the evangelical community don't approve. He says he's heard the murmurings.
The Muslim lover, the Muslim-loving pastor, which I have responded to when I have the chance to say, what choice do I have? I love everybody. Like, I don't think I get to pick who I love.
Faith and Culture Center President Daoud Abu Diab says the efforts of Christians to reach out has been deeply encouraging to Muslims, especially during the most difficult times. In 2008, his Islamic center in Columbia, Tennessee, was firebombed by three white men.
Those were three young men who have self-identified as Christians, who lived in our community, and who later on explained that in their perception, what we were doing in that Islamic center was against the teachings of their Bible.
But in the days after the attack, Abu Diab says Christians, Jews, and others mobilized to support members of the destroyed center.
For me personally, that changed my definition of what a community is. It was the people who hold the same values in their hearts.
Paul Galloway, executive director of the American Center for Outreach, says people of many faiths are hoping the bridge building in Nashville can be a model for other communities struggling over religious diversity. He showed me a recent ad in the Tennessean newspaper, which was signed by leaders of many different faiths.
No matter what we believe, where we come from, or what our differences might be, together we're better. And it really just says, no matter what else happens across the world, no matter what happens in Tennessee, as Nashville, our values are to be welcoming, and we're going to work together and respect each other.
And Graves believes that's a message that is needed now more than ever, not just here in the U.S. He says he hopes someone in Egypt is writing the book, How Not to Kill a Christian.
One of the things we hope that comes out of this is that Christians in other parts of the world, where it is difficult to be a Christian, we hope that their lives are better off because how we're treating Muslims in the United States.
I'm Kim Lawton in Nashville.
We have a Lucky Severson story now on what many scientists are saying about finding intelligent life on other planets, somewhere out there among the billions of universes and galaxies. From NASA to the Library of Congress to the Center of Theological Inquiry, ethicists and astrobiologists are pondering the possibility of other life elsewhere in the universe. How would finding extraterrestrial life affect our religious beliefs and our view of ourselves?
The book of Genesis, in some versions of the Bible, says that God created the heavens and the earth. Note, it says heavens as in plural. Does that mean there is more than one? And could there be other earths? And the big question, other children of God? And if there is, what then?
The Bible makes it clear that the God of Israel is the creator of the whole universe.
Ted Peters is a professor of systematic theology at the Pacific Lutheran Theological Seminary and one of an increasing number of scholars known today as cosmotheologians who are asking the question, what would the discovery of extraterrestrial intelligent life mean to religion?
I think that the God that called Israel out of slavery in Egypt and created the planet Earth is also the creator of all those other worlds out there. And I think there are good reasons, speculative reasons, for thinking that we've got brothers and sisters on other planets in outer space.
And why not? As these Hubble telescope images reveal, it's a big neighborhood out there. This is Steve Dick, a former historian for NASA and author of 7 books, including most recently, The Impact of Discovering Life Beyond Earth. Dick knows a thing or two about the universe.
So our galaxy is about 100,000 light years across. That means if you were in a spaceship going at the speed of light, 186,000 miles a second, it would take you 100,000 years to go from one end of the galaxy to the other end of the galaxy. There are hundreds of billions of galaxies in the universe.
To me, it seems like it would be a miracle if there isn't life somewhere else.
Doug Bakoch is the president of METI International. METI stands for Messaging Extraterrestrial Intelligence. In other words, he's trying to get a hold of extraterrestrials, and has been for several years.
You can tell what a person believes by how they spend their life. And I'm looking, I think they're out there. But I don't have any proof.
Composing a message is tricky business. Bakoch says earthly languages won't work, but math may be a universal tongue. First, he hopes a message won't convey the wrong meaning. And then, of course, there's the distance thing.
If there's a civilization out there, it's 100 years, 100 light years, or 1,000 light years away. So we're talking centuries or millennia to say hello and hope they just don't come back with, "What was that? Would you repeat, please?"
I'm a little bit impatient with my fellow theologians who, when they talk about creation, they talk about planet Earth. The planet Earth, as Carl Sagan said, is just a tiny little pale blue dot compared to that great big grand magnificent cosmos that's out there.
20 years ago now, we knew of no other solar systems, no other planets beyond ours. Now we know of thousands indicating that they're everywhere. Almost every star you look at has planets.
You're inclined to believe there's life out there.
That's right, I am.
There was a time when it was considered heresy to say there is other life in the universe.
Whenever I go to Rome, I always visit, not the Vatican so much, I've visited there, but I visit Giordano Bruno, who was burned at the stake in February of 1600, in part for his belief in life on other worlds.
Religious attitudes have moderated considerably, but for some, the notion that there is other life out there challenges fundamental Christian beliefs.
The usual notion is that Christianity would have a special problem dealing with intelligence out there, because it would take us away from being the center of the universe. And so I think for some people that's threatening, because somehow we won't be as special as we have been.
The central doctrine of Christianity is redemption and incarnation. If there are thousands or millions or billions of planets out there, the question is, were they redeemed when Jesus Christ redeemed humans on Earth? Or do you have Jesus Christ who has to travel around to all the planets, or something similar, a sort of planet-hopping Jesus?
Professor Peters is also a pastor and co-editor of the Journal of Theology and Science. He conducted what he calls the ETI Religious Crisis Survey, and he asked this question.
Would your religious beliefs collapse if we could confirm that we share our universe with extraterrestrial intelligent creatures? And overwhelmingly, we're talking about 90% in every one of these religious categories said, no, my faith will not suffer.
Peter surveyed all the major faiths, including Buddhists, Hindus, Muslims, and Christians.
One would have expected that the evangelicals and the fundamentalists would have greater difficulty than your mainline Protestants or your Roman Catholics, but you know what? It was the same. You had evangelicals saying, I know E.T. isn't mentioned in the Bible, but I believe they're out there.
I think it would be a big adjustment for Christianity, much more for Christianity and the religions, the Abrahamic religions that have a single Godhead, rather than the Oriental religions, which, you know, don't, like Hinduism, which has, you know, many, many gods.
Well, there are passages in the Bible that talk about there being many mansions that are inhabited, and some historically have said, oh, that's evidence that the Bible talks about extraterrestrials. Others would say the fact that there's no explicit reference to extraterrestrials mean they're not there.
So what would happen if, say, tomorrow we made contact?
There are no official protocols on what should happen if life is discovered. The military doesn't wait for things to happen. It has all these contingency plans. I think the same thing should be true of as a contingency for when we discover life under whatever scenario.
In 1999, Congress cut off funding for the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. It was considered too hypothetical.
The most important reason to search for extraterrestrials isn't even to find them, but to understand ourselves better. You know, we have assumptions about what it means to be human, what it means to be intelligent, what it means to be civilized. If we have the opportunity to meet someone indirectly through radio signals from another world, that will give us a radically new way of looking at ourselves.
This knowledge that you have does not impact your faith.
Yes, it does, but it only in a positive way. I think there's a much bigger universe out there to be appreciated in terms of God's creative ingenuity.
In October 2018, NASA plans to launch a telescope 1 million miles into space, twice as powerful as the Hubble telescope, that may reveal far more of what is out there. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, I'm Lucky Severson in Berkeley.
On our calendar, Sunday, May 1st is Easter or Pascha for the world's Eastern Orthodox Christians. Like Western Easter, Pascha celebrates the resurrection of Jesus. Also on our calendar, Jews around the world commemorate Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Remembrance Day, May 5th. At a time when few Holocaust victims remain, the Jewish youth group BBYO invites them to tell their stories to encourage future generations to know their history and be proud of it. We listened in as survivor Lola Byron shared her experiences with teenagers at a Sabbath dinner in Montgomery County, Maryland.
In 1939, September 1st, 1939, Hitler's bombs fell in Warsaw. In December, my father, his two sisters, and his mother was divorced, and his mother decided that they needed to leave. And my mother, who was not yet married to my father at the time, decided to go with him. So think about this. So here you are living comfortably in Montgomery County, and somebody says to you, we have to go. You can't take your stuff. You got to get out of your comfortable house. You can't take your furniture. You got to go, and you got to go now. You know, what would you say? My parents ended up in a small Russian village, and that's where I was born, in Siberia. When the war ended, they went to Poland and found that no one was left. There was no country to come back to. There was no family to come back to. And there were many people like my parents and me. Americans and British set up displaced persons camps. So that's what happened. I lived in Germany. I went to a German school. And I knew, I understood, that no one was supposed to know I was Jewish. When I came to the United States, and we were living in New Jersey, I was trying to figure out who I was supposed to be, you know? And I was trying to give the right answer. And Jewish was the wrong answer.
The biggest thing I got out of Lola's story was how important it is to be proud that we're Jewish. Most of us are at a time when we're looking at colleges and trying to figure out where we can go and be ourselves and find our identities while still being proud to be Jewish. Lola experienced so much anti-Semitism. There's still a lot of anti-Semitism in our world today. You hear stories every day of buildings being spray painted with swastikas, and something that's so important is staying strong and staying proud. This event is called a Shabbat to Remember, and it's so important that we do remember, and that we remember these stories and we can pass them down to our children and our children's children, and just making sure that nothing as horrible as the Holocaust ever happens again.
As you were all standing up and doing this Havdalah service, I thought, isn't that amazing? So many Jewish young women feeling completely comfortable, with where they are and what they're doing and not having to hide and not having to, you know, do it kind of on the sly. It's a gift. It's really a gift.
That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook and watch us anytime on the PBS app for iPhones and iPads. There's much more on our website. Join us at pbs.org/religionethics. As we leave you, an interfaith gathering sponsored by Auburn Seminary in New York. Participants reached out to support the Muslim community by singing, "Ain't Gonna Let Nobody Turn Me Around."
Turn us around, ain't gonna let nobody turn us around. We're gonna keep on walking, keep on talking, marching after freedom land.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding also provided by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're your retirement company.
Be more. PBS.